I'm Bob Niedringhaus, and I'm not a regular member of the teaching staff here. I'm actually a guest, but I was I've given this talk once before at home, and Jackie wondered if I would give it last week, and we discussed this last week up here with a smaller census in the village, and we had a forum the night after with some good conversation and discussions, and so we're going to do it again this week. My wife and I have been coming up here for the last 12 years. I've been here for the last 10 out of those 12 years, and she's been here for the last 11 out of the 12 years, and she's been coming up here enough that she wound up on the board of directors. She's been coming up for quite a while. What I wanted to do as a kind of an introduction is, I don't know if any of you have seen this book in the bookstore, but Dorothy Bass, who's the editor of this book, Practicing Our Faith, is a friend of the village and a friend of ours. And in the preface to her book, I just wanted to share what Holden Village has meant to me and my family over the last 12 years, and it sounds like it does the same for her. She writes in her preface, "Every summer, my family visits a retreat center high in the mountains. My husband delights in the hiking and fishing. I thrive on the absence of phones, television, and grocery stores. And the children revel in the freedom they have to roam about unsupervised in a small, safe, mostly outdoor community of friends. All of us enjoy the natural splendor of this place. But there is also something stronger and deeper that keeps us going back, something harder to describe. When we are there, we slip into a way of life that comes pretty close to our vision of how things are supposed to be. As staff members, we work, we consume appropriately, eating lower on the food chain and doing without the goods and gadgets that usually clutter our lives. We worship daily. In other words, we enter a community shaped by shared practices that seem to make sense. And as we adjust to them, we feel ourselves becoming a little bit different, a little bit better." I think that kind of summarizes probably what a lot of us feel about Holden Village. And part of the way we become different is by learning up here. I was thinking last night how I've become different just by coming up here over the last 12 years. I think I'm a different person. When it comes to thinking about the environment, I'm a different person in my thinking about peace and justice issues and global concerns. I think different about homosexuality and capital punishment and some of the issues of our day. I think different about the relationship between men and women because of Holden Village. This place also gives us an opportunity to talk about things that sometimes we don't have a chance to talk about in our congregations or in our society, especially when there's societal changes going on that impact our moral beliefs and call on our interpretation of the gospel in our day-to-day lives. And I think that the issue of physician-assisted suicide is one of those issues. It's a topic that's gaining momentum, and it's going to challenge us, I think, every bit as much as the abortion controversy has over the next few years. One of my partners in oncology says that anybody dumb enough to come to see me as a patient is essentially committing physician-assisted suicide. But just to give you some idea, I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. Just to give you some idea, in the community our size of maybe 85,000-90,000 people, we've had half a dozen newspaper clippings in the last 6 months. One here from actually beginning in October of '96. Court takes up suicide aid. It has to do with the Supreme Court considering this right now. They say on a broader societal level, the outcome of this case will have enormous influence on whether assisted suicide becomes a standard part of our nation's medical practice and what will occur in hospitals, clinics, and doctor's offices around the country. Catherine Tucker, who is representing the Washington and New York physicians who challenged the laws against physician-assisted suicide, argues that mentally competent adults should be able to choose to end their lives in a certain humane and dignified manner. This is a real opportunity for all competent dying patients to gain the right to hasten their death. Another article from February of 96 in our paper, "No wonder the dying are seeking suicide. Doctors do little to relieve their suffering." Ellen Goodman, April 18th, 97, "We don't have words for the Dutch concept of assisted suicide." An article by Clark Morphew in the St. Paul Pioneer Press, a Lutheran pastor who writes the religion column, "Chronically ill can accept and live with pain," from April. Another one by Ellen Goodman, "A delicate balance between patients' rights and doctors' duties," from April 25th. Some of you may have seen the Lutheran this last month in June, "No magic pill, assisted suicide can't cure dying." There's quite a bit in the medical literature right now. There's an article in the New England Journal of Medicine from October of 96, "Pharmacologic Treatment of Cancer Pain." There's one from the New England, from the Annals of Internal Medicine, January of 97, "Practical Issues in Physician-Assisted Suicide." Another one outlining the numbers of people that are helped to die in this manner in the Netherlands, euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide in the Netherlands. The cover article of the New York Times magazine section, week of the Sunday New York Times, "The Case Against Doctor-Assisted Suicide." So this is something that's not far-fetched. It's in front of us, and I think we need to talk about it. I've been out of medical school for 29 years. I went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, the University of Minnesota, and the Mayo Clinic for my education. I've been in practice in Duluth, Minnesota for 22 years. I practice in a clinic of 300 physicians, which is currently seeing patients in 23 different sites. My practice has two main areas. I have an internal medicine part of my practice, which is like other physicians in internal medicine and family practice. And then I have then I practice hematology and oncology, the latter of which takes most of my time and energy. Oncology is the treatment of cancer, is a constant, ever-changing battle. It's a little bit like being at war. It involves a variety of technical, emotional, and spiritual issues, like few other areas in medicine or nursing. With changing weapons and high expectations on the part of the public. These expectations are often primed by the media, which understands it's a common problem. It's associated sometimes with pain and oftentimes with death, and everyone is worried about getting it. It's a battle we sometimes win, but too often lose. So that I find myself participating in the death of about 75 people a year, or about 1 to 1.5 a week. Let me begin by saying that the average person who contracts cancer experiences a variety of emotions. But I can assure you that the idea of hastening their death is seldom, if ever, a part of at least that initial conversation or interview. People even in their 80s, many of whom we would think have had a full life, raised their families, worked hard, enjoyed the fruits of their life's work, almost invariably want to fight the disease as hard as they can. This despite some treatments that are toxic, costly, even when the disease is advanced and there's no hope of cure. It's still difficult, for example, to tell someone in their 80s with advanced pancreatic cancer, for which there's no known effective treatment to extend life, that comfort measures are the most appropriate thing to do. This news, even in someone in that age group, I can assure you it doesn't go down very well. The typical person with a mortal disease will do almost anything then to realize a cure, even if the treatment itself is risky and life-threatening. If the cure isn't possible, we are usually asked to help them fight the disease as long as we possibly can. When anti-cancer treatment fails, or the disease acquires resistance to the treatment, we then have to adopt the hardest part of the care, as far as the patient is concerned, attending to comfort, pain control, quality of life issues, time with their family, time out of the hospital, nutritional support, and spiritual needs. As physicians, we enter this time oftentimes feeling like failures, despite sometimes a zealous and overzealous efforts, and the patient can sometimes feel abandoned. This is the time, it seems to me, that people might want to contemplate ending their lives voluntarily. Although in the last 22 years I've only had two people ask me point blank to help with this, and both people felt differently when they were enrolled in our hospice program and died comfortably and quietly with their family and medical support. I'll just illustrate how this can work with a recent case that I had just before I came up to Holden. I lost my glasses hiking a couple of weeks ago crossing the creek, and I've also got a hearing loss, so the only sense I've got left is a little bit of common sense. this is a man who I saw just a couple weeks before I got up here, a kind of a typical case. Jim is was a 65-year-old man with cancer of the esophagus. He had been cared for at the VA hospital in the Twin Cities, and I hadn't known him before. He lived in a town close to us, had come home after about a year of battling his cancer in the VA hospital, ready to die. His family called me up. I happened to be on call that day for our group. And basically, they were begging to have me help him die. He was in terrible pain. He was on morphine, some long-acting morphine, 60 milligrams total morphine in 24 hours orally, which boiled down to about 2.6 milligrams an hour. I admitted Jim to our hospice unit. By the time we got his pain under control that day, he was requiring 30 milligrams of morphine intravenously every hour, which translated into about 120 milligrams per hour orally, or about 50 times what he was taking at home before his pain got under control. He died comfortably with his family present. And they felt good about his death and good about his care on the fifth hospital day. We live in a society that doesn't talk about death very much. We certainly haven't until lately wanted to talk about our own death, and certainly not about our own suicide. A variety of events have changed this. And as I thought about it, the first one, I think, was Cecilia Saunders in England and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in our country beginning discussion in the 1970s about trying to describe the stages of grief and bereavement in the face of bad news and imminent death. And they also start talking about physicians' feelings and the feelings of other healthcare providers in dealing with death. They laid the groundwork for the hospice movement, which emphasizes pain control and preparation for death when necessary. And the second event was the Karen Quinlan case in 1977. Here was a situation where caring, competent parents were not allowed to withdraw life support from their daughter when they wished. The public was horrified. And I think it galvanized public opinion enough to give birth to the third event, the Living Will Movement, or Healthcare Declarations. Healthcare declarations, or living wills, rose out of the public's concern that they might wind up, have something unexpected happen to them when an advocate wasn't around, wind up in some emergency department, cared for by a young, enthusiastic doctor who puts them on life support against their wishes. This has evolved to where it is now a state law that patients admitted to hospitals in Minnesota have to be exposed to a healthcare declaration opportunity to act on if they wish. The fourth event, of course, is Dr. Kevorkian, a retired pathologist who has assisted in dozens of suicides over the past few years, currently being prosecuted by the state of Michigan for his actions on behalf of patients who sought his assistance. The public reaction to the press coverage, it seems to me, of Dr. Kevorkian is one of relative indifference, either because we don't take the situation seriously or people just don't think it's that controversial. But what do we know? What do we know from history? Suicide was a felony under English common law and illegal everywhere in this country into this century. There was a strong belief that the lives of individuals belonged to the community in which they lived and to God who gave them life. Today, our lives seem to reflect the belief that we are accountable only to ourselves, that our lives are ours alone. And although we try to prevent suicide, we no longer punish its attempt. The interest is rapidly rising, however, and discussions like ours today are beginning to occur. Spearheading this interest right now are a few court cases. Some of you here may be from the state of Oregon. In November of 1994, Oregon voters approved a ballot making it legal for a physician in that state to prescribe a lethal dose of medication for administration by the patient. And although I understand this is still tied up in the courts and hasn't been implemented, this was the first state to do this. In Washington State, in March of 1996, we had another case, Compassion in Dying versus the State of Washington. The State of Washington rested this case on the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the same clause in which the courts have upheld the right to seek an abortion. The right to end one's life, the court explained, was a direct descendant of the right to choose whether to bear a child. And as with abortion, the state must have a very strong reason before it may interfere with this sort of a private matter. Less than a month later, last spring, in New York, the case of physician Timothy Quill versus Vaco was tried in the Second Circuit Court of New York, which struck down, as a result of this case, New York's ban on assisted suicide. The court did not support the previous reason that they did in Washington, but used another part of the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. New York has allowed mentally competent patients on life support or terminally ill to direct removal of supporting equipment, much the same as we do in Minnesota, and I'm sure in Washington, even if it hastens the death or in fact causes immediate death. It prohibited, however, those who did not need life support from obtaining drugs to cause their death. So the court maintained that the state was discriminating, allowing some terminally ill people on life support to die quickly, but not others. The argument then can be extended, why not anyone? If we don't do it for people on life support, and if we now don't do it for people, we allow people who aren't on life support to terminate their life, why not let anyone terminate their life? Because our rights under the Constitution are not based on whether we're on life support or in fact whether we have a terminal illness, but whether or not we're citizens. So the issue is currently being addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's apparent to me anyway that this is going to be a hodgepodge, and it's not going to be the best way to resolve this kind of a moral dilemma. But unlike abortion, it's certainly going to affect physicians, and I think it's going to affect every one of us who at some point in time is going to have to confront our own death. The American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, the American Geriatric Society oppose the legalization of physician-assisted suicide. However, the medical profession is increasingly aware of public opinion and wondering if it will have a role in the future care of terminally ill patients. A national phone survey in 1991 indicated that 52% would consider assisted suicide or euthanasia. I think that the Oregon vote was about that. I think it was 52 to 48 or 51 to 49. So this is pretty standard around the country. Among the reasons that people cite that they would want to have this opportunity is they don't want to be a burden to their families. They don't want to live in pain. They don't want to be dependent on machines. And they don't want to be dependent on others for their personal care. Physicians report some other reasons. These requests may be prompted by inadequate relief of their symptoms, depression, problems in their interpersonal relationships, spiritual issues, and problems with anxiety, grief, and sleep deprivation. In a survey in Washington State last year, physicians who received requests for suicide cited these four reasons as being the most common: loss of control in their lives, being a burden to their families, losing their personal dignity, and being dependent on others for their personal care. These seem to be much more common than unrelieved pain or unrelieved symptoms. We know that the patient's mental state can sometimes be nebulous. Dementia in its early stages can sometimes be hard to define. The point at which the disease affects the person's ability to give truly informed consent is a very difficult area. Delirium is often found in cancer patients and in people, for example, with AIDS. And this can affect their ability to see their options clearly and make informed decisions. Depression is quite common, and this may in turn influence decision-making, magnifying life's burdens, and diminishing appreciation of life's benefits. One of the other problems we have is how do we define who's terminal? I'll tell you a little story I was just thinking about this morning during Bible study. A few years ago, I was on weekend, I was working on the weekend, and I was making early morning rounds about 6:30 in our intensive care unit, and I looked down the hall and saw one of our parishioners from First Lutheran Church, and he was obviously distraught. He was pacing around the waiting room. So I went over and asked him what was wrong, and Maury told me that his wife June was in intensive care, was being taken care of by one of my partners, and was very ill. She had picked up an infection, had overwhelming pneumonia, was on a ventilator, had dropping blood pressure despite aggressive blood pressure support. Her kidneys weren't working very well. There were questions about her neurological state. She had overwhelming pneumonia and was in septic shock. Not a good thing. Wasn't responding to blood pressure support, antibiotics, and so forth. And it looked like she was going to die. I took a look at her, and it sure looked like that too. Her physician told Maury that went on and told him something. I'm not sure exactly what happened. I wasn't there, but this was a Sunday morning, and Maury called our pastor. We had a new associate pastor at that time who was a little bit green, hadn't been around the block too many times, and he thought that Maury said that she was already dead. And in fact, announced it in church. And, And in fact, it was on the radio. Everyone listening to the church, well, June turned the corner that afternoon and walked out of the hospital 8 or 9 days later perfectly well. And they got a lot of sympathy cards, but one of the funny things is that when June recovered, she said, "I want to know who the widows are that are sending Maury all the hot dishes." It can sometimes be tricky to know who's terminal and who isn't. Sometimes people ask us how long they're going to live, or a term I hate even worse, how long are you going to give me? I always say, anytime I've guessed, I've been wrong every time. And I'll give you another example of how that can work. This is a 72-year-old man from northern Minnesota who had a malignant melanoma removed from his right scapulary area, his right shoulder blade, in 1994. It was widely excised, the proper treatment for that, and there wasn't anything else we can do but surgically remove it and hope. He had no signs of recurrence until May of 1996, including May of 1996, but in July of 1997, in May of 96, he had a normal exam, his lab work was fine, his chest x-ray was normal, but in July of 96, he came in with a lump on the sole of his foot, which we excised, and it turned out to be a metastatic lesion. And at that time, his chest x-ray, unlike 2 months prior, was now peppered with metastatic disease. I wish I could show you his chest x-ray, which probably had 20 or 30 tumors in both lungs. It looked like he was terminal. Albert was 72. He didn't want to die very badly. He didn't feel sick. He loves his grandchildren. He wanted to live a while yet. So we talked about our options. I didn't push anything on him. The chemotherapy for this disease isn't very good. It's quite toxic. The chances of it working are 25-30%. There's no hope of cure. We only had a hope of controlling it. But he elected to go ahead. And between July of 96 and October of 96, he had 4 months of chemotherapy. By September, his lungs were clear. In April of 97, his lungs remained clear. And as of 3 weeks ago, he's still clear. So here's a man who, if he had had a room full of physicians, no one would have thought he would have lived 3 to 6 months at the rate this disease was going, who's now had about 10 months of life off chemotherapy and still feeling well. The disease is eventually going to come back. Nobody in his situation has ever been cured, but this was worth it for him. He was terminal last July. I don't know if he's terminal right now or not. Albert certainly has drafted a living will. We've talked about exactly what we're going to do when the disease comes back again. He's outlined very clearly, and we worked out exactly how much support he's going to have next time. But this can sometimes be tricky. Which of these diseases, for which there is no cure, then, are terminal? How about diabetes, macular degeneration of the eyes, rheumatoid arthritis, kidney failure on dialysis, congestive heart failure, Alzheimer's disease, cerebral palsy, multiple sclerosis, a debilitating stroke? Most physicians, at least when I went to school, went into medicine for idealistic reasons, and I think most still do. If we're lucky, we fight to retain this turf despite the turmoil and pressures currently undergoing medicine in our society. We went to school to learn how to combat disease. And if we're lucky, we've also learned over the last few years that part of our job is to educate the public in how to stay well as long as possible. Although disease and death are ultimately going to affect each and every one of us. Being told we're going to be expected to help people commit suicide is not part of our makeup. And I expect resistance to continue on the part of medicine, as we're already beginning to see. We believe there's a vulnerability on the part of the patient in their trust and relationship with their physician, and that this is reasonably sacred turf. The ability of the person to divulge their personal history, to disrobe and be examined, to accept our prescribed treatment. I doubt there's another relationship in our lives except marriage, which result in this kind of immediate trust and voluntary vulnerability. The patient expects us to be their advocate, to assume their fight. In our profession, the fields, there's little room for the idea that we might also have to help kill them. Dr. Kathleen Foley, an oncologist at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, said, "If doctors are allowed to kill patients, the doctor-patient relationship will never be the same again." We certainly have to attend to people's pain, but I have patients say that the experience in hospice brought their families together through the experience of suffering with their loved one, which in many ways was the most healing part of the whole treatment process. Ira Byock, a physician in Missoula, Montana, who works with terminally ill people, says that death is neither to be fought at all costs nor to be courted, but to be richly orchestrated. He says, quote, "What I see in those who advocate physician-assisted suicide is a real deficit in imagination. I'm continually amazed and humbled that something good can come of this last portion, however grim or painful, of a person's life. There is always that letter to be written to a daughter whose graduation the dying person will not attend, a son to be told how wonderful he is, and a strange relationship to be repaired, whole stories of growing up to be tape recorded," unquote. I think that I see people who want their death to mean something, for accounts to be settled. The dying process can be accompanied by heightened awareness, contentment, and connectedness. This can happen even when death isn't pretty or easy. Dr. Byock describes a case of a young man dying of AIDS who begged him to help him die. His religiously fundamentalistic family was appalled by him. So much was unspoken and unsettled. Gradually, the hospice team was able to bring them together, and to see that father gently bathing his son's rectal herpes was nothing short of a miracle. "Just think about it," he said. "It's all right there, the moment of truth. This man died in peace, and his family will always know that they loved him, something that wouldn't have happened if I or some other doctor had listened to his request for suicide." Just a couple other cases to illustrate how tricky this can be sometimes. This is a woman currently age 53 who I take care of, who in 1979 developed chronic myelogenous leukemia. This was at that time an incurable disease. She was depressed and wanted to die. She was only about 35 at the time. She finally consented to 3 years of oral chemotherapy, and at that time, bone marrow transplantation, even though it had been going on in the 70s, was now appropriate for her disease, and in 1982, she had a bone marrow transplant from her brother, remained free of disease until 1990, when it relapsed again. She's currently controlled again for the last 7 years on oral chemotherapy. She's quite compromised. She's oxygen dependent, quite weak, has a variety of other problems related to her marrow transplant, but she's satisfied with her life and has a decent quality of life. Again, a person who was terminal almost 2 decades ago. I take care of a little boy, Tommy, who was born with a condition called Fanconi syndrome. He was born in Seattle, was expected to live no longer than a couple of years. His disabilities include aplastic anemia, which is a severely dysfunctional bone marrow. He doesn't make any blood, much blood. He has multiple skeletal anomalies. He's very short. He has deformed hands, arms, and fingers. He has difficulty walking. He can't swallow due to a malformed esophagus. He has only one dysfunctional kidney. He requires, and his family accepts, tube feedings through a tube in his stomach, daily injections to stimulate the white cells in his bone marrow, almost weekly transfusions of red blood cells and platelets, and a chronic indwelling intravenous catheter to accomplish all this. His father thought he would take a couple of years out of his career plans and work to take good care of his son. His mother has the economic power in their family. We decided the bone marrow transplant wasn't worth it with all his other anomalies, and and just to attend to his quality of life. That was 11 and a half years ago. He still will not, he still is not going to live a lot longer. I think he'll probably die sometime this year. But without him, his family would not have been the same wonderful people they are today. His father wouldn't be one of the men I admire most in this world, and they would not have experienced the joy that he brings to their lives. As he goes to school, studies, asks questions, and gives his younger sister a hard time. When he dies, it will not be with assisted suicide, I can assure you, but with love and comfort, and it will not be the relief that many think it might be, and they don't want it to come any sooner than necessary. I thought I would just finish by talking a little bit about how we should look at this as Christians, and just say that it seems to me that suffering, even though suffering is bad, it's part of our life. Jesus suffered. He certainly didn't promise us life without suffering. What we are promised is in Romans 8:38, which on occasion I've read to some of my patients. We believe there's no condemnation for those who are in Jesus Christ, and we know that in everything God works for good for those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. We are sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Jesus Christ our Lord. I'm going to just throw out a couple other things about dying, and then I hope that we have a chance for a little bit of dialogue. One way to think about this is, if you look at our birth and you look at our death, we're all kind of dying. We're all kind of dying in here. And for example, I found out that at age 30, we all tend to start losing our bone mass. And no matter how much calcium or vitamin D you take, your bone mass continues to drift down from about age 30 on. But there's a point in time when, and this is a hard time to define, when we actively enter the dying process, and when the person and their healthcare providers and their family decide when this time is, can be tricky and it can be hard. It's different for different people. There's no, I think of all the people I've seen die, I don't think that there's any, that there are any formulas for making this slick in here. Everybody's death, I think, is different. Every single death is different. But I think it's something we should think about. In my work, I think about my death every day. What kind of a death would we see as ideal? I think probably most of us would say a death that's free of pain, it's pain-free, probably a death that's surrounded by family and friends. A lot of people would say that they would want to die at home. I think it's probably important to have an opportunity for lamentation, for sorrow, and a time for reconciliation in our death. And I think as Christians, it's also important that we have a time to acknowledge that God's love for us extends beyond death. And the only other part of Scripture that I could think was that was really appropriate for this particular topic was from Romans 14, 7-9. We do not live to ourselves, and we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, so that he might be Lord both the living and the dead. Why don't we have an ideal death every time? And who usually does this? I think one of the things that gets in the way is the medical establishment. I can tell you that it's not the medical establishment's choice all the time to be the people that are helping people die. I think a lot of other physicians like it. If we have to be the most important person in somebody's health life for a while, I like it when we can close the treatment process, enter the palliative care or hospice time, and let the family and friends take over and let us move into the periphery. I like it when I can enter somebody's room or visit them at home and not be any more important at that point than anybody else who's visiting them. And I think if we can accomplish that, we're successful. But people don't let us do that very often. So that the medical establishment sometimes has to take over this stuff. The other people that do it are funeral homes. If you look at the newspaper ads nowadays, funeral homes have gone from taking custodial care of the corpse, care of the body, to promising sympathy, care, and peace of mind. What are the obstacles? I think a nice blend between medical support and family are hospice programs, which are thankfully becoming much more common in our country, not only in our big cities, but now or even in our small rural communities. And we can maybe talk about that during our discussion time. But hospice blends some medical support, family support, staying at home, spiritual support, and so forth. Some of the obstacles, it seems to me, in doing this are cost of care. We heard Mark Edwards talk the other night about the cost of education. Medicine has the same set of problems. It's too expensive. There's government cutbacks. There's high technology, rapid change in technology. Everything's expensive. Everybody's stressed out. We're all having to do more with less. But all kinds of care costs money. Home care costs money. It costs more to have a nurse. It costs almost as much to have full-time nursing care at home than it does to be in the hospital. Hospice care costs money. Some of that's reimbursed and some of it isn't by third-party payers and Medicare. And, of course, hospital care is very expensive. Just having a hospital bed and paying for all the accoutrements of being in the hospital is very expensive. Some of the other obstacles for having a good death is that the family can't be there. The family is too busy. We have both members of the family working. We have many single-parent families who are trying to support their children. They don't have time to take care of their parents. Everybody's too busy, and everybody's distant. We don't live near our parents anymore, and it's hard to time when you should come. Should I come at the last week before my mom or dad die, should I come back and forth? I've got a job, I've got kids in school. It's very difficult for families to support it, and that's why some of this gets put back on medicine again. There's some things in taking care of somebody who's dying that are repulsive for families. And there's secretions, there's uncontrolled diarrhea, there's pain, there's shortness of breath, there are scary things, there's mental confusion, delirium. Families get exhausted doing this very long. There's a changing clinical state. What seems to be stable one is the next, and people get scared and want to come back in the hospital again because they don't think they can handle it at home anymore. So I wanted to throw that out at the end. I hope I've given you some idea where we're at with assisted suicide. It's at the Supreme Court right now. I don't know how this is going to shake out with the Supreme Court, whether they're going to have a ruling, whether they're going to kick it back to the states. But it's something that's going to affect all of us, and I think we need to talk about it. But I think part and parcel of that, we need to talk about, and more importantly, I think, I see assisted suicide as not being real compatible with this kind of a mode of dying, where you have an opportunity for family, friends, freedom of pain, a time for reconciliation and lamentation. I don't think that necessarily that fits very well with this. It also continues to have medical people constantly involved in the situation. Why do people have to have physicians assisting with suicide anyway? So I think that more importantly, assisted suicide ought to probably be the incentive for us to talk a little bit more about dying, how we want to die, how dying fits into our faith, and how we can change things so that some of these dynamics that are getting in the way of the proper dying process can maybe be addressed or fixed. So with that, I'll quit, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions or comments. I know there are people in the village right now who are struggling with this situation, which is partly why we decided to talk about it again. Ingrid Christensen, in her lawyer writing session yesterday, had a very rich outpouring of stories from people, many of whom are in our village right now. This is a common problem. I think we all have it in our families, either now or will have or have had it. So I know there's a wealth of experience and opinion here. So, yes.
I saw a film for about an hour and a half by Dr. Nancy Snyderman. Have you happened to see this?
No.
She was interviewing families of dying people. And the conclusion that I came out of watching all this, I think she's on CBS, I could be wrong on that, was that even with all your living will and the, what's the other one?
Yeah.
That covers all these things, even that isn't enough if the family isn't right there with you to be an advocate for you, and that was really her point. You need an advocate.
No, you don't. You don't even need a living will. A living will isn't a legal document. A living will can be overturned at any point in time. The main advantage of living wills is that if you have we ran into a situation where maybe somebody has something terrible happen to them, maybe in their 70s or 80s, and their children are outside, they live in California, and they come home, and the physician and the patient knows that they don't want to have a feeding tube, they don't want to have ventilators, they don't want to have machines, and that's been part of our agreement over the last few years, and the patients may be rendered incompetent or not conscious. The family can come in and say, no, we want this, and that's why we like living wills. We love living wills. It gives us the chance to tell the family, no, this is what your mother and dad want, and we're going to honor this. Living wills, I mean, that you don't have to have somebody right there all the time. There are plenty of people who are living alone in nursing homes or at home by themselves who have something happen where the ambulance drivers know that they're not going to resuscitate them, they're not going to intubate them. If they come into our emergency department, there's a sheet on the chart that indicates what they wish and what they don't wish to have done. But you don't have to have somebody physically there. No, that's not true. Yeah.
So if the family disagreed with the living will, and the person is not competent, who ends up with the say-so?
The person who's, if the person has outlined what their wishes are, and they're not competent anymore, I think that's got to be respected.
The doctor would.
The doctor would say, listen, this is what your mother and dad want. We're going to respect this. And most children don't have any problem with that. Most children, though, haven't talked to their parents about this, so they're not sure. And it helps them to know that you've got something in black and white and that they've talked to their physician about that. The patient has the right to decide what they do with themselves, whether they're conscious or not. And if they've outlined that ahead of time, I think that can override what the children might decide.
But the best of all would be if you talk with your children about
Absolutely.
It.
If you can talk to your children know what you want, then that just avoids any kind of conflict.
But if you're traveling or something, and you have the living will, and people don't know it, and you're in accident homes, and they start all these procedures, and even, like, I carry one with us, but sometimes it wouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, most of the time, you're going to be conscious. Almost all the time, even if you're in an accident, or you're, or somebody will be with you, or somebody will be able to come and be your advocate, but, I mean, that can be a problem, though.
Yeah. I don't have any problem with the doctors we have in our own community, but
right.
It's when you're out.
Sure, no, it can happen.
They don't know you.
Right, it can be a problem.
It is possible for one child to change the living will and to convince the rest of the family that the living will should not be honored. I've seen that many times.
I think one way to address that concern is through a durable power of attorney, which hasn't been raised. Because the living will doesn't hold up in all courts all the time as a legal document, but a durable power of attorney does, which means you identify one person who will make your health care decisions for you if you're not competent to make those decisions, and you would choose the person who understood your intentions in the living will.
I don't think the durable power of attorney can be always honored. Another family member can question that power.
But that's legally, though, as a legal document.
It's more of an agreement. It's not a strictly legal document. I'm saying it's not fail-safe.
I think the other thing to understand is that most people don't have, most people it's verbal, but most people it's still verbal. Most people can tell us. I've been undergoing cancer treatment for the last 2 years. We're losing the battle. It's time to quit. And that's all it takes. And they don't have to have anything in writing. They can say, I don't want this, I don't want that. You don't have to have a ream full of papers. Most people don't. Most people who die don't have anything in writing. They just, that's just what they want. And verbally is good enough. And in fact, a person can verbally overturn anything in writing anytime they want.
Yep. My experiences are different than yours in a hospital. I'm on a fire department where we have EMS response. If you don't have the DNR, our protocol says resuscitate.
Well, they'll do it. No,
so it starts when you dial 911. If you don't have all that in order, then you do need to have your paperwork there. You can't do it verbally a lot of times.
We just tell people don't dial 911.
That's right. That's the best way.
You can't dial 911. If you have a living will and you don't want resuscitation and you're home dying of cancer, you don't want to dial 911.
It puts those people on the spot.
It sure does. No, that's a big problem.
Yep. A little different about what you said. I want people to remember that I'm a hospice nurse and we do home care. We do not have an inpatient hospice. And we do get people's pain under control in the home. It's nice that they were able to go in, but I do it every day in the home, and severe pain, we do it at home. The other thing that I wanted to say is I hear a lot of people who have problems with guilt about not being with somebody when they die. Very few people, when I see them at home, die with somebody with them. They usually die alone. And so I get real nervous when I hear people saying that you die with your family and your friends. I don't see it much. So if you have somebody who died alone, don't feel guilty about it.
No, and I think what you say is true. We have about 125 outpatient hospice patients, and we have an inpatient bed of eight beds, and we mainly use that for initial evaluation if people are in the hospital to get them into the home setting, or family exhaustion, or somebody where the nurses just can't handle it at home temporarily, might come in for 2 or 3 days, but most of our patients die at home too, and should.
Yeah. I think I heard you say earlier, one of the commentators said that physician-assisted suicide severely damaged the patient-doctor relationship. I'm not sure that I perceive it that way, so could you speak to that? Do you see it damaging?
I mean, I haven't, we haven't had it happen. We're afraid of that. I think that's the other side of the coin. I mean, I think there are people who could argue that if you're really going to be the patient's advocate, that you'll let mentally competent patients direct that kind of traffic, and that if you're going to have real trust with your patient, that's what the advocates say, and I think that's open for some debate. I don't think we know what's going to happen with the doctor-patient relationship. The doctor-patient relationship is getting watered down anyway for a lot of different reasons. But there's still trust there, as I mentioned. I think there's still a unique relationship. If any of you have ever been sick, and I've been sick, and I know what it feels like to have to become vulnerable, to take off your clothes, to accept what happens, it's still a unique thing. And whether or not that turf is going to be impinged by knowing that your physician, in fact, in the Netherlands, there was some stuff in the New England Journal, in the Netherlands, about 2% of patients right now die with assisted suicide. And one of the concerns that people have is that most of those people don't bring it up themselves. It's brought up by their physicians. And so I think the fear that you might have a physician who might bring it up when you don't want to bring it up is part of that trust thing that could be shaky. But I don't know. I mean, I think maybe this will work, and maybe that won't be challenged. But I think there is that side of it that if you're really going to be your patient's advocate and do what's really best for them, this might be part of the package.
Bob, if I may just amplify what you're saying very gently. I mean, looking at the context of healthcare right now, where physicians and other healthcare providers are increasingly being seen or needing to act as employees of large healthcare corporations, which make profits based on the less healthcare provided, I can see very clearly that patients would distrust physicians who, in a state of chronic pain and difficulty, the physician and the provider would suggest such a thing. I don't think that's very far off or very
right.
far out.
Right. If you get somebody, if I have somebody who's been battling their cancer, say has leukemia, and we've been battling it for a few years, this really gets expensive. Insurance companies want them dead. They're nothing but a drain. In the last few months of their life, their care gets very expensive, and that's when the clinical managers who work for insurance companies start calling us up. What's going on? What are you doing? What do you expect to happen? How long is this person going to live? I get those calls every day, and so you know they're relieved when it's over. Their financial stuff is gone.
That's insurance.
Yeah. that's part of everyday life for physicians right now, whether you take care of terminally ill people or not. If you're a child psychiatrist and you put somebody in the hospital, the insurance company is on you in 24 hours. What are you doing in the hospital that you can't do at home? What are you doing? What exact treatments are you giving? That's part of our everyday life right now. And so assisted suicide is going to be fit into that framework. As Doug said, I think this could be problematic when you look at cost of care. It's a lot easier to knock somebody off than to put them in a hospice program.
If this becomes part of the expected process, do you see the development of a subspecialty in medicine?
Not yet, Bob, but I don't, you know, who knows?
Subset of pathology, perhaps, along with Dr. Kevorkian.
It is interesting that Kevorkian was a pathologist.
Right? Kevorkian's a pathologist who never took care of a live patient, you know, during his regular career. This Timothy Quill from New York has. Quill is a fellow in the American College of Physicians. He's well-respected in medicine. The patients who he brought to the case in New York were people he'd taken care of for years, were friends with. He became their advocate, and I think that this was part of what he thought was the appropriate thing for the patient at the time. I think his patient had AIDS. Of course, AIDS has changed in the last 6 months. And so, somebody else over here? Yeah.
Pastoral care is awfully messy. So, black and white and the righteous helps, but down in the trenches of the pastoral care, let's take that oncology case one step further. It is inoperable. It is untreatable. I choose, for the sake of my own family, my own personal decision, that I simply do not want to extend my life or prolong treatment legally. Are you in a position to cooperate with my pastor, my doctor, oh, sure, my family?
Sure.
To assist me in terminating my life.
Sure. As that was, Albert wanted to quit last July, I wouldn't have twisted his arm one bit. Oh yeah, no, that's your right anywhere along the line. You always have the right to withhold any kind of treatment, whether it's cancer or not. You don't have to have your pneumonia treated. You don't have to have anything you don't want to have done.
Can you aggressively assist me in terminating that life?
Can the physician assistively?
Legally. Is that
you
the
can't, that's another gray zone. We can't legally give somebody a lethal dose of medicine, but we all know from dealing with people who are say in a lot of pain, that controlling their symptoms, putting them on morphine, giving them sedation to control their anxiety, letting them sleep, there's a lot of medical treatments to control their symptoms that undoubtedly shortens their life some. That they would live longer if you let their pain go rampant. It depresses their respirations, it sets them up for pneumonia, it debilitates them, it makes them tired, they spend more time in bed, they get weaker. But the trade-off there is pain control. And I don't think there's any doubt that happens. That's one of the gray zones here.
My husband died last summer. I came to the hospital the morning, his last morning, and I asked for a chaplain. She came and she stayed with us until 2 hours after he died. We called the pastor and he came and did the service of commendation, and the family was all around the bed. And then after a while, somebody, I don't remember who, asked if they could discontinue the ventilator, and we said yes.
Sure.
Which is very hard to do.
Yeah. It is hard.
I never expected him to die because he always came through all his other aspirations.
Yeah. It is hard to do. It's harder to stop the ventilator than it is to not start it to begin with.
But I'd been there the day before with a nurse friend of mine, and we had sat by his bed, and they were doing continuous cardioversions, which is trying to get the rhythm of the heart. And he was bouncing off the bed, and I thought, oh, this is terrible.
Others?
What about preemies, when you have very, very small babies born, pound, 2 pound, and the amount of money that is spent in trying to you take care of these.
What was the question?
The question was, how about premature babies when they're very low birth weight babies? The amount of money that's spent in trying to salvage them, not knowing what they're going to be like, maybe neurologically later on in their lives, and whether the cost is worth it. I don't know.
That's the gray area on the other end.
That's the other end of the spectrum. It's just, it's the same kind of a problem. Same kind of a problem with even more emotion involved. A lot more emotion involved. Most parents will do, and certainly parents who have little children with malignant disease will do anything to save their child.
Where does medicine come down now on the question of is life owned by the individual or owned by the community?
I think we're probably in a situation, Bob, where we operate that life is owned by the individual. And the individual can always override the wishes of their family, their community. I think we have to respect, we're that patient's advocate, we're not the community's advocate. The patient pays us, in fact, to be their advocate. So that, I think that's where we're at right now. But that could change, I suppose, too. Yeah, somebody else?
Basically, what you're saying is that if it's not broke, don't fix it right now. You can assist somebody in dying, even if it's not actively, it's more passively. And you think that if there were assisted suicide legalized, you think there would be problems such as the HMO economics of what not go into it. Is that correct?
I think economics would get to be a factor.
That's one of the things.
Yeah. I don't think that's what's driving this, but I think that.
Yeah. Well, I've often tried to figure out why would people be against not legalizing, where if somebody wished to do that, they could. And I could never think of a reason why it should be illegal, but I see that abuses could develop. But that's, you can get into a lot of what-if situations on anything. It just seems that making it illegal, or it's illegal now, it makes people become criminals, per se. I mean, even though they're going to be dead. But the people that's assisting them, I guess, it makes them criminal.
I mean, if most people want to kill themselves, they don't need assistance. All they need to do is shut the garage door and turn on the car.
Yeah.
I don't see why they need physician assistance to begin with.
That's a good point.
That's one question. I don't know why they need the doctors to assist.
Yeah, they want. It's part of what's wrong. I think they want the medical establishment to bless it.
Yeah. Okay. That's what they're doing.
They want it to bless it.
Yeah.
We're the high priest. They want us to bless it.
Yeah. Okay.
Or to do it painlessly.
Right.
Well,
you can't beat carbon monoxide.
You can do it painlessly.
What's in the medical establishment? Is there a general response to the Dutch protocol solution, however you would describe the availability of end-of-life medicines?
With this issue,
is there a general sense in the medical community?
There's a general sense that we don't want to deal with it. We don't want this. We don't want to have to do this right now. But that might change. But there's certainly a general sense we don't want to do this. I think organized medicine said that, and I think the individual physicians almost uniformly would say that.
In Holland, in the Netherlands, is it the physicians themselves that do the assisted suicide, or is it the anesthesiologist? It seems to me that I've read that. But
yeah, and I think it works a variety of ways. I think the physician can provide the patient with the necessary medications to do it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I mean, I think that's the way it's usually done. I don't think they put an IV in and give you a dose of strychnine or something.
No. Okay.
Or potassium. I think it's probably allowing the patient to have that option. I don't have people doing that, but I've got people at home who have a month's worth of morphine on hand. We don't count pills anymore. We give people a wide variety of options in terms of their own pain management. And people can do it with morphine anytime they want. I don't think I've ever had anybody do that. We certainly have at least a couple of weeks of medication on most people.
There was a book put out not too long ago, I think, telling people how to help themselves commit suicide or something. Have you seen an increase in like use of that book? Or?
I haven't seen the book, no.
Yeah, I forget.
There's an Oregon publication, Final Exit, by Humphreys, Derek Humphreys.
Is that right?
It's on your computer. It would be on the internet,
Well, thank you all for coming.